events anymore. We call them unintentional injuries, like unintended consequences for certain behaviors. And we call them collisions, motor vehicle collisions. We just call them MVAs, motor vehicle accidents. We don't call them motor vehicle accidents, we call them MVCs, motor vehicle collision. Intimate partner violence is becoming recognized as a major problem. And it doesn't matter what ER you work at or what community you live in. You can have patients that are victims of domestic violence.
Thank you.
And it's not just men beating up on women, it's women beating up on men, women beating up on women, and men beating up on men. That it says the leading cause of injury to women. Like I said, it's not just women alone, it's any kind of partner. The sexual assault nurse examiner, that falls under forensic nursing. And they're called in when there's been a sexual assault. If it's domestic violence that doesn't involve a sexual assault, then that's law enforcement. So you might have a nurse that works with your local law enforcement that may come in and do an assessment. The sexual assault nurses are called in and they kind of take over the investigation as far as collection of evidence, using the rape kit, and finding counseling and aftercare for the rape victim. Well, not all communities have same nurses. So the ER nurses are the ones who will collect the evidence with the physician, the emergency room physician. So part of your training as an emergency room nurse is learning how to be an evidence collector. There are some legal and ethical issues when you work in the emergency room that you have to abide by. Like I said, if there's ever a law enforcement involved, where a law's been broken, or potentially a law's been broken, it's a gunshot wound, it's a stabbing, it's an assault, it's assault and battery, you're a part of the evidence collecting. There's some things you document, there's some things that you don't document because it's illegal. Because it can be used in, they are used in the court of law. And those are also things that are specific for emergency room nurses. Alcohol and substance abuse are a leading cause of our motor vehicle crashes and fatalities and boating accidents. Motor vehicle crash kills someone every 30 minutes. It's a leading cause of 585 billions of dollars in healthcare costs each year. All right, so how many of you watch 911, 911 Lone Star, Chicago Med, Grey's Anatomy? Okay, when I say Grey's Anatomy, everybody's arm will do it because I know everybody wants Grey's Anatomy. That's why y'all decide to go nurse school because you watch Grey's Anatomy. At least that's what they tell me. All right, so I'm a fan of 911 and 911 Lone Star and Chicago Med. And one of the things that I've noticed, and even if, you know, you don't have to watch the whole show, but they give great patient report when they're bringing the patients in. They talk about vital signs, they talk about the injury, they talk about the mode of the injury, as if these people, I mean, they are believable. Now, there are some times where the facts are just a little bit off, and I'm like, no, that's not right. But for the most part, their delivery is very accurate, so that it's the kind of report that we want when those of us who are working in the emergency room. And where you work depends on the kind of report that you get. I worked at Wills-Knighton North, where it's just the radio from the emergency personnel bringing a patient in. But a few years ago, I worked at San Juan Regional Medical Center, which was a county hospital in Farmington, New Mexico. It was the only gig in town. Even though they were a level 3, because of the resources that they had, they functioned well above their certification. And so our dispatch was the dispatch. So our radio got whatever the 911 calls were getting in. The 911 dispatcher, when she was calling law enforcement, fire department, first responders, we heard everything that she said to them, sending them out into the wilds. And I'm not exaggerating. These are places that, you know, may have had a mile marker, and that's where the instructions that they gave. It's the third tree on the left. We get patients in coming in with their stretcher, and they had their flashlight in their hand, like big strobe flashlight. And I said, what is this for? And he said, well, I had to go stand out at the end of the road so the ambulance would know where to come and have his light on. So these people live in very remote areas. They would have to go out to, you know, the reservations and pick up patients that, you know, may or may not have had electricity. So you might live in a city that has all kinds of resources, and you may work in say. So anyway, my point was, you would listen to the instructions of kind of getting the report from what was the 911 that was called in, and it could be all over the place, and they're trying to explain what was going on. And so if the staff would have some idea, I was like, are we getting a stabbing? Are we getting a shooting? Are we getting an assault? My absolute favorite that I will probably remember for the rest of my life is shots fired, one dead, one missing. And you always get concerned about the one that's missing, because where's the one that's missing might ultimately show up? That's right, your front door. Not the front door of your house, the front door of your emergency room. Walking in to the waiting area of your emergency room with God knows what kind of injury. You know, you've heard the stories about the shootings where they dump them off in the ambulance bay of the emergency room and then take off. You know, like ring the doorbell and then they take off, and there you are with your wounded patient. So then it was like one was missing and we have three injured, don't know if the scene is safe, but this was like in a neighborhood. So it was like organized chaos. Like some of you who've been in any code situations in the hospitals, it's, you know, everybody knows what their role is going to be. And so we know, have some idea of what's coming, and we automatically do what? Worst case scenario, right? Those wounds that we think we're going to get are going to be really massive. So we start, you're going to go in this room, we'll put one in this room, we'll put one in this room, and then we get another call and say, oh, there's a stabbing that's coming in. So we're going to put the stabbing over there. It seems to be unrelated to the original. So do you know what happens when you have that kind of situation? You get your patients, the sheriff's department, the state police, the local police, the media likes to come, of course, you know, they want to, you know, exciting times like that. So you have different people who are involved in crowd control. So in this particular case, we had this guy who was the shooter. He was one of the shooters. This guy got shot. He's the one that came in the front door. He had shot him because he had shot his friend. That was the one that was dead. The one that came in the front door, that was the one that was missing. This girl over here, she was shot in the arm. That was his ex-girlfriend who, for some reason, decided she needed to go see him that night. It was a drug deal that went bad. Her parents had no idea where she was, and she'd never been involved with someone like that. So they were totally mortified when they get the call that their daughter's been shot. So we got parents having a meltdown. So when you have situations like this, when we call these trauma alerts, chaplains come, surgeons come, lab comes, pharmacy comes, everybody comes, because you don't know what you're gonna have. So it ended up not being as bad as it could have been, and nobody died, and faces got sewn up, and, you know, all the law enforcement kept this guy away from this guy, and then everybody went to jail. So, it's exciting. Everybody's got an adrenaline rush. So, The pre-hospital is what the EMT first responders are doing, okay? And they're gonna call, they're the first on the scene, whether it's a car accident, car on car, car on pedestrian, car on motorcycle, motorcycle on pedestrian, whatever it is. Assault, fire. So when they get to the hospital, if they're in, depending on what kind of state they're in, resuscitation wise, depends on what we call. So we can call a level one trauma alert, we can call a level two trauma alert. I know that I've been in the ER at Rapides, and it's because they are a level one trauma. Ochsner's is a level one trauma for this area, and then University Hospital New Orleans. So we used to only have one level one trauma in the state of Louisiana, and that was when it was just Big Charity down in New Orleans. So now we have three. To be a level one trauma, you have to have, it's based on the resources that you have available. It's anesthesia and surgery, trauma surgery specifically, available in-house 24/7. Okay, if you don't have that, level two may have those resources available, but they are not in-house 24/7, but they are called in and available to perform emergency surgeries. Then once they get in and we see what we've done, what's necessary, then you'll take care of any operations that need to do to stop bleeding and repair injuries or set bones, whatever's necessary. And then there's the critical care for those who need critical care, or they can just go to an intermediate care, like a regular medical surgical floor. And then ultimately they end up in rehab based on their kinds of injuries. Triage. So those of you who have been in the emergency rooms, you know that there's the first place a patient goes when they check in is they have to be triaged. Right? So the triage nurse's job is to decide who goes first, right? Worst job ever. Do you want to know why? Because I have to explain to you why your ingrown toenail for the last 4 weeks is not as important as her stroke. She goes first, all right? Her 5-inch laceration with her box cutter as she was opening at work that's spurting out blood, she goes first, right? So we have a level. They're called the ESI. And when it's probably one of the first things you learn in emergency. We have 5 categories. Number one, code in progress, right? If there's a code in progress, if they come in bagging and doing chest compressions, that's a level one, okay? That's an ESI level one, right? Level two, okay, so it's based on the resources that they're gonna need. So they're intubated, they're gonna need a ventilator, they're bleeding, they're gonna need a rapid infuser, they're gonna need to go to surgery, multiple x-rays, CAT scans, the list goes on and on. Gobs of fluids, lots of resources, lots of personnel are gonna be involved. That's number one. Number two is someone who can't sit out in the waiting room. Okay? Depends on, and plus what kind of resources. Now they can wait in the waiting room, certain ones can wait at the waiting room tonight. Okay, so chest pains in the waiting room. No. Okay, stroke symptoms, sit in the waiting room. No. Both are gonna need EKGs, CT scans, maybe clot bluster, go to cath lab, lots of labs, the list goes on and on. One of a level two, that's a level two, may not seem to you to be a level two, but they're a level two because they can't sit out in the waiting room. They're not gonna need a lot of labs, not gonna need IVs, not going to need surgery, don't need a CAT scan. What do you think it is?
I've tended to rapidly. The types of injuries that we're talking about, and sometimes it's very...
It's not supposed to be on the
I thought Athens had took over. I was
what do you
like,
think
wait
it is?
No.
It's what? A suicidal patient. A suicidal patient, if it cannot be left out, okay? Because they're a one-on-one. Do y'all realize that? Okay. So, a suicidal patient, it only has to happen to you once. And when I went to work at a group, I worked to work at a facility, and they just let their suicidal ideations sit out in the waiting room like, yeah, I guess they haven't had that one that went out in the car, brought in the note, put it on the desk, and went back into the parking lot and shut their brains out, okay? Once they say they are suicidal, they must be in someone's view at all times, okay? Woe be to the person who does not take that job seriously and comes back and sees their patient hanging from, you know, whatever they can figure out to hang themselves from, okay? You'll have a lot of explaining to do, and you'll probably, you know, you put your license at risk. So if you ever have a patient that you're one-on-one, okay? So then there's number three. Three is headaches, abdominal pain, things that are going to maybe need x-rays, IV drugs, fluids, nausea, vomiting, those kinds of things, but that put the patient at risk for, you know, getting worse. Fours and fives are the ones that we lovingly call treat and street. You know what I mean by that? Treat them and street them. They're not going to need a lot of resources. They're going to go home. You know, they're not going to, that's where your urgent cares come in. That's where your fast tracks come in. That's four. A five is even less than what four is. So I like to put, my fives were, I missed work today. I need a doctor's excuse. No kidding. People will come to the emergency room because they need a doctor's note, because they didn't go to work, because they had a sore throat. All right, any questions? So they're called ESIs, and they're a level, they're the triage levels. Oh, God, y'all, I forgot to put record. Oh. Start recording, yes. Am I recording? I don't know if I'm recording. Yes, I'm recording. Okay. Three group for the people that, so triage means to sort. There's five levels, one being the worst, five being the least worst, the less significant. Codes in progress is a level one. Level two is chest pains, strokes, and homicidal patient. A homicidal patient will typically be accompanied by law enforcement, right? And suicidal are often accompanied in by a suicidal of by law enforcement because the family called 911 because the patient made it. So anyway, also what they'll do is with a suicidal homicidal patient that you should do immediately is change their clothes to a god-awful purple, oversized, take everything. You don't want if this person is seen on the street, your community is educated, it's like, okay, they either need to be at Central or Brentwood because people aren't supposed to be walking around town like that. Because they all knew that the purple gown was for the psychiatric patient. Take away their phone, you take away everything, and you don't let their families, because their family may be a big part of the problem, so you can get, you know, they're going to get PDC, they're going to be a one-on-one, which means they're going to take up resources. So, all right, algorithms. Let's talk about treatment algorithms. These are things that we use because they're based on evidence. They're based on standards of care, because over time, these are where the best outcomes. So number one, MI, what's the first thing you do? Patient comes in, I have chest pain. Chest pain protocol is?
EKG within 10 minutes.
EKG within 10 minutes. While someone's doing the EKG, someone else is starting an IV. When they're starting an IV, they're drawing the labs, because what do we need? We need a troponin, right? Okay, so you got a lot of people moving really fast. Somebody else is grabbing what? Two things, two drugs. What are they grabbing?
Nitroglycerin.
Someone's grabbing a nitroglycerin, and someone has asked the question, did you take aspirin? How many milligrams? Yes, 325, okay? If all they had was 81, they need to take four, right? So someone's getting the aspirin, we give them the nitro, we're watching their blood pressure, we're doing their vital signs. So we've learned over time, by moving this quickly and getting our information, we save our patients. We have a better outcome, right? We can rule out the STEMI. We already have cardiology alert. Over time, we have become so good at this that the first responders are running the first 12-lead EKG in the field, and they are sending that to the ER physician, and they can go ahead and read it. So we already know what's coming. And if it's a STEMI, then we're already prepared. We've already called the cath lab crew, the cardiologist on call, and they're on their way, because they know that they're gonna have to, you know, be in action. And they may, you know, in some places they may stop by the door and give admissions their information and head straight to the cath lab. They may not even stay. Because you know, if it's a STEMI, it doesn't really matter what their troponin is, right? I mean, you would like to have the troponin, but if you've got an elevated ST segment, you know you've got an active MI. All right, so we have the same one for stroke. We have a protocol for abdominal pain. We have a protocol for headaches. We used to, before you went to computer charting, you would go in the ER and there would be this rack of pages, and they were labeled headache, abdominal pain, chest pain, numbness in, you know, just a whole gambit of symptomatology that a patient might come that were their most likely diagnosis, and the doctors would pull those out and they would fill out, they were called the templates, and they would fill them out. So those of you who are scribes, how many scribes? Where's my scribes? No scribes, she must have left. Anyway, scribe? Okay, so were you scribing the ER? Do they have something like that for the electronics that they can pull that, or is it just generic now? Okay, yeah. Anyway, they don't use it anymore because of that. Okay, anybody got any questions on that? I gotta make sure this does not. Maybe once. Okay, good. All right, traumas, types of injuries. All right, it's often unclear when you have these kinds of, this that we're talking about right now, they're called the high index of suspicion, because you're not really sure what's going on inside, right? So with the blunt force injury, and what do you hear on you know, Law and Order? Blunt force trauma, right? Blunt force trauma. So it's a forceful contact with an object. That object could be another person's fist, a pole, a 2x4, a vase, anything that could, you know, hurt somebody, right? Motor vehicle, fall, you know, the object is the floor. Contact sports, crush injuries, in what we call, in our motor vehicles, we have the acceleration, deceleration, and so you can have a shearing. So what do you think in a motor vehicle accident would cause shearing of the aorta? We have safety devices now that we didn't used to have. You hit the steering wheel, and the passenger hits the dashboard, right? So those older vehicles that in, and it may be subtle, and your patient, your the person involved in the accident gets out of the vehicle, walks around at the scene, everything's fine, and then so they said, well, let's just go to the hospital and get checked out anyway. This happened to one of my best friends. So they put her in the ambulance. This was in Natchez. She hit the dashboard. They're on their way to Alexandria, and they have to stop in Jonesville because my friend's gone into shock. My friend had a dissected aorta from the trauma of hitting the dashboard, and she died. The head injuries, when Ms. Akins is going to talk about traumatic brain injuries, the acceleration, deceleration, when you hit something. How many of you ever got whiplash when you got, you know, rear-ended? You're just sitting there in your vehicle, minding your own business because traffic has stopped, and the idiot behind you is not paying attention until it's too late and slams into you. Luckily, you have the fortitude. This is why we don't tailgate, people. Okay, you think, oh yeah, I'm gonna tailgate, I'm gonna drive on the ramp. No, stop doing that, okay? Because you're like this far, and if they come with, they're going 50 miles an hour down I-20 or faster, and they don't stop, and they slam into you, guess where you're going? You're going into them, the person in front of you. So now you've done this and this. So what are you gonna feel tomorrow? You're gonna hurt all over, right? Hopefully you won't hit anything. Airbag won't deploy, your face gets all scratched up. So those are injuries. And so you have, you know, the coup, contra coup. I'm sure y'all heard that before, those kinds of head injuries. Ms. Akins will talk about that. So these are all traumas. Injury related to the rapid change of velocity. That's what I'm talking about. Speed kills, right? I have a lot of, you know, reservation working out in the middle of nowhere stories. This one night we got a family in that had been involved in a vehicle accident because the person that was driving intoxicated forgot to put on their lights. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been out to the Wild Wild West in these remote areas. They don't have street lights. They don't have highway lights. They barely have stars, right? And it's dark, it was cloudy, and so there was no lights anywhere. The drunk person gets in their car going 80 miles an hour down the highway, no lights on. So the family pulls out and just gets creamed by this vehicle at a very rapid. Everybody in the car had a fractured pelvis, except for one. They just got into him. How it didn't kill them all, I don't know. But yeah, and so that was just one of these four people. Like I said, they weren't a level one trauma, but they should have been because of the amounts of violence that they had in their community and the sports in their community and stuff. Motor vehicles, you can be ejected. There can be a rollover. There can be, if you're an unrestrained driver, there's a prolonged extrication. They used to call it the golden hour, that once you get on scene, you've got an hour to get the persons in the vehicle to, with this level of injury to a facility. So out in the middle of nowhere, guess what got used a lot? As long as the weather was good. Fixed wings, not necessarily, helicopters, right? So we had a very large flight nurse team and a couple of helicopters that were constantly transporting patients. They would go out in the middle of nowhere, land that helicopter, put in a chest tube, intubate a patient, call report, and get them to us as to the nearest facility as quickly as they could. Motorcycles and ATVs, wear a helmet. I don't understand. Yes, New Mexico is as bad as they were and unsafe as they were. They didn't require people to wear helmets. So the worst one ever I had, we never saw at the hospital because when he got hit, somehow he hit a pole. And have you ever seen the poles that have the thick wire that kind of holds them down to the ground and anchors them a little bit? You ever seen those? Well, This pole had one of those. And so when he hit it, when he got hit, he went airborne at the velocity he was, it just decapitated him. Imagine driving down, going to the grocery store on a Saturday afternoon and seeing that. Try to get that out of your, you know, it's like, I can never unsee that. Yeah, I'm sure those people had nightmares. That had to be awful. One of our security guards was riding his motorcycle. He got framed. One of my friends was on her board. She saw the whole thing happen. She did just tumble. She was the first one on scene. She said he was gone within minutes. So people should wear helmets. Road rash, you know, when they abraded on the sidewalk, you know. Have you ever seen these where they fall and they kind of slide and they just keep on going where they're attached to the motorcycle like this? So imagine the worst abrasion you've ever had, all up and down your leg and all your back. And everything. So it's basically a burn, okay? Because you've lost your whole first layer of skin. And the motor pedestrian collision has to do with how fast they're going. You know, it's a big difference if you get hit by a car going 50 miles an hour, you're not gonna survive that. Or if you get hit by a car going 15 miles per hour. Yep, you'll survive that one, unless what happens? If they hit you and you crash your head and you have brain bleed and then boom, you're gone. Penetrating injuries. These are the ones where it breaks the skin. Stabbing, missiles, bullets, knives, swords. There are people out there who play with swords. You know who you are. Well, you know who the family members are. You don't have to admit that you do it. Getting impaled, falls. The damage can happen along the internal path, so you don't really see what's happening. So when a person sustains a gunshot wound, all kinds of violence is happening depending on the bullet that's being used. A lot of times the things that the ER doctors will ask when the law enforcement, you know, accompanies a shooting, and sometimes they're reluctant to share with you exactly what kind of bullet that they used, but it's important to know so you have some idea of what you're working with. So you want to know, was it a 9mm, a 38 special, a Judge, you know, what was the wound? Because you have some idea of the severity. You know, a 9mm and a 22 and a BB are not going to cause the same amount of damage, right? How far away they were with the knife, what was the angle, you know, did they go up, did they go down? Yeah, don't watch those forensic shows and stuff. I guess, you know, y'all will go back and watch television one day, I promise you. And this will, you'll go, oh, I know what that is. All right, so any questions on that? Blunt force trauma as opposed to a penetrating, pretty self-explanatory. So the golden hour is very crucial to timing. The emergency EMS in the field, they call 911. We get them stabilized. We get them to surgery. We try to get, you know, so like in this area, Willis Knight North is not a level 1 trauma. Willis Knight North is maybe classified as a level 2 because we don't have trauma surgeons and stuff. Where is your trauma hospital? It's down the street, right? So here's Willis Knighton, and then there's Oshner's. So it's right there, okay? But when you think about your socioeconomics, where do a lot of the shootings and stabbings and violence happen? By Willis Knighton North, right? A lot. So they bypass Willis Knighton North to get to their level 1 trauma. Does that make sense? Absolutely. Why? Who has the resources? The trauma center. You want to get your patient to the trauma center. But sometimes you got to stabilize, see what the patient's doing. So if the patient's not stable and you need to do resuscitation and all that good stuff, get them on ventilator and everything, they'll stop in Will's Night first. Will's Night, they won't even, they'll just do a look over and they just put them back in the ambulance and go down the street. For those of you who know anything about Will's Night, the same thing happens when a pregnant woman comes in, because we don't deliver babies at Will's Night anymore. You know, if someone, pregnant woman comes in Will's Night late, where someone has to go clean off the warmer. When I say clean off the warmer, I mean clean off the warmer of all the stock that we've put on there, because we don't do that. So we hope, it's like, can you make it to South? Fingers crossed. Can you make it to South? Because that's where they deliver babies for Will's Night. If not, guess where you're going? You're going to Usher, because they deliver babies at Usher. Now, we will deliver, but there's nothing we can do. It's like, we deliver your baby, and then bundle you and baby, and send you across town. So don't even come to, you know, tell your friends, tell your family, don't ever go to Will's Lightning if you're pregnant, because we can't help. All right, rapid response to the emergency room. Like I said, there's the triage, there's a trauma surgeon, the RNs, respiratory therapy lab, x-ray, social workers, and pastoral care. It's all hands on deck. And one of the things why they call the level, why do you think they, and when they know that they're going to get a level one trauma or a level two trauma, they announce it overhead? Who do you think needs to clear their table if they've got a patient on the table?
A wall.
X-ray needs to have a free table so that any kind of x-ray or CAT scan that needs to be done in the immediate to see where the injuries are, lab will be there, a chaplain will be there in most places. Lab, what do you think lab brings with them when they come? They bring 4 units of what kind of blood? That's right. They bring 4 units of universal blood. Nurses, the triage takes place at the time when they roll in, as far as the hospital is, the emergency department's in. But they've already got a good idea, based a picture of what they're getting based on what the paramedic, emergency medicine, first responder crew has given them. All right. And then from there, once we get the patient stable, what's the first thing we want to do about our patient? What's the absolute first thing that has to be done when they get there? Are they breathing? Okay. Are they breathing? Breathing, circulation. Are they bleeding? What am I going to be doing if they're bleeding?
Pressure.
I got to stop the bleeding. Okay. So I'm holding pressure to where the bleeds come from until we can get enough stabilized enough. Rapid response level one is a, you know what that is, because you saw it used this week, huh? Yeah, get it. Interesting experience. So the rapid infusers are these devices where you can put 2 units of blood and slam them in, but at the same time, it's a warming device. So as they're being slammed, they're being warmed, you know, to get the patient up. And there's a couple of devices. Level one was the original. There's a Ranger. There's probably another one, you know, since then. But they discovered that giving cold blood over a rapid amount of time can send your patient into an anaphylactic state. Okay. So now they've got these devices that you can go in just as fast and be warm. Okay. You may have work in an emergency room. All our fluids were, you know, have your blanket warmer. Well, our fluids were in the same kind of device, so all our fluids were warm for our patients that came in, that we would have to do any kind of fluid resuscitation. Okay, so then we're going to look for, is it a gunshot wound? Is there an entrance? If there's an entrance wound, I'm looking for a... Okay. If I don't have an exit wound, what's the matter? My bullet is still inside. Okay, so... So we look for an exit wound. You roll your patients over. You know, I'll talk about assessment in a minute, but these are the things that when they initially come in, you know, bleeding, breathing, level of consciousness, the neurological status. So we're doing all these things at one time, and You know, it's a lot of people that are in the room. Like I said, X-ray has to be there because they're mostly because their tables have to be free so that they can get the patient there as soon as possible. Now, you know, think about this. When you're going from place to place to place, you know, you've got to put them on a stretcher, then they're in the hospital stretcher. Then they got to go to the, get on the table for it, and then they get back on the stretcher. And then, so there's a lot of, you know, if you think you want to work in the emergency room, you have to be physically fit. At some level, you have, because it's a very physical position. All right, okay, let's talk about assessing these patients. So there's the rapid primary head to toe history, front to back sample, okay? Star this, people. Sample is something you'll see. It's an acronym, it stands for. S stands for signs and symptoms. How are they breathing? Are they bleeding? Is there an injury somewhere else? Is there a break? Is there a fracture? Is there a swelling? What do you see? What are they complaining about? What's their pain level? Where is their pain? Can they describe their pain? How much bleeding do you have? Any allergies? You always want to know your patient's allergies. If you can, you want to know your patient's medications. What is your patient taking? Hopefully, if your patient is not able to tell you that, there's a family member that can provide. Chances are, and they are very good at this, is your first responders, when they go to someone's house and they're going to bring in a patient, they operate on this very same thing, right? In fact, family members sometimes say, do y'all people even talk to each other? Because y'all just keep asking us the same things over and over and over. It's like, you can't remember my name? You can't remember my date of birth? But they'll get the medicine list. They'll get the past medical history. They get the patient's allergies. Past medical history, past surgical history. Patient diabetic, patient has COPD, patient as an alcohol problem, patient is a substance abuse problem. When did they last eat? Why is it important that when the patient last ate? Because if they go straight to surgery, what's the first thing we need to do before they go? Put down an NG tube and do what? Suction it out and hope it's empty. Because if they got big chunks of food, that's going to be a problem. All right, E stands for event in environment. What happened? Okay, what was the event? What happened to this patient? He got shot, he got stabbed, he got hit by a 2x4, he got hit by a fist, she got hit by a fist, she got pushed out a window, she got pushed in front of a car. The list goes on and on and on and on. She got pushed off the sidewalk, she fell off the sidewalk, tripped over on 2 feet in the middle of the sidewalk, okay? We've had people that tripped on ice, and guess what they got? They got subdural hematoma and died. So something that may seem minor to you doesn't necessarily turn out that way. All right, so I've asked those 5 questions. Then I'm gonna do the head, neck, face, chest, ab, and flanks. So I'm going to roll that patient over. I'm going to stop right here. Patient at a motor vehicle crash will 100% arrive to your facility with what in place?
Neck brace.
A hard cervical collar. What do you think they're going to be screaming about to get off them? The collar. If you've never worn one, you should put one on sometime. They're awful. But what are we trying to do? We're trying to stabilize what's fine. Why? Why is stabilizing a cervical spine
so
important?
Because it controls your lungs. That's the
sometimes you're gonna have to be ugly to some people. You're gonna have to grow some kahunas and say, we're just trying to help you. Okay? We're just trying to help you. They don't understand. They're uncomfortable. They're scared. They're stressed. They're traumatized. They don't understand that if they have a slight nick of their cervical spine above 5 and they turn the right way and that slices or punctures that spinal cord, they will stop breathing. And they will be on a machine, if they're not dead, for the rest of their lives. They will be dead. You know, they won't poop on their own. They won't pee on their own. They won't be able to talk. They won't be able to breathe. You know, it can be very, very bad. Okay. So, I roll them over. We log roll them. So someone's at the head of the bed and they hold that in place as they roll. Okay. And they're the one that control everything. They say the 1, 2, 3 and they turn them and then they turn them back. Okay. Then, now this is what bothers me on television. When they come in and the ER doctor immediately takes off the collar, that's not what happens. He's not supposed to come in and just take off the collar. He takes off the collar after the CAT scan comes back. Because only the CAT scan can confirm that there's not a problem. All right? Just because he can move his head from side to side, we don't want them to. Don't ask him that. He may unloosen it. He may touch back there and ask for any pain. But he ain't taking that sucker off until he gets a CAT scan report that says everything's fine. There's no injury here. Okay. Any questions? All right. So log roll. Do a scan. Inspect all the body surfaces and folds. The doctor, okay, you don't do this. The doctor will do this. Is going to come in and he's going to check the pelvis and the perineum. And he's going to put his hands here. He's going to make sure it's stable. And when they roll over, he's going to take a gloved hand with lube. And he's going to stick his finger up the patient's anal area. What is he looking for? If there's a spinal cord injury, what's not going to happen? It's going to be what? It's going to be flaccid. So he's looking for rectal sphincter tone to make sure it's intact. Because if not, you're going to suspect spinal cord injury. Right? So we're looking for exit wounds, any other kind of wounds. We're looking for abrasion. You're doing a skin assessment. You're looking for anything. You're looking for previous scars. You're looking for tattoos. You're looking for markings. You're looking for anything. Okay? Alcohol and recreational drug use can kind of interfere with our assessment, so make a note if those are involved.
I got it.
Now, if any of this is involved in a law enforcement issue, you have to follow their protocol because that is a crime scene. Okay? If it's been a gunshot wound, if it's a gunshot, it's an assault, if it's anything, it's a crime scene. Your patient is a crime scene. So he has to be treated differently. Clothes are bagged up and marked. And sometimes patients have to get undressed on a sheet, and the sheet and everything gets put in a bag. It all goes to forensic. Blood samples, hair samples, you know, pictures, whatever. So you have to be very careful. You have to follow the protocol of the state where you live. Okay? Some things are federal law. Some things are state law. Some things are parish. You just go, your law enforcement people will be in attendance overseeing everything that's done. If you're lucky enough that your community does have a forensic nurse that's attached to one of your law enforcement, that's great because they just kind of come in and oversee everything and help. So you got your pre-hospital and you got your ER resuscitation. It's kind of redundant. Your primary and secondary surveys. Okay, that's your ER. So primaries, A, B, C, D, E. And then there's E, F, G. Right. A, self-explanatory, it's airway. right? Is it clear? Is he intubated? Is he breathing on his own? Is he having difficulty breathing? What does his chest look like? Is it going up and down? Is it going up and down and up and down? Or is it going up and down and up and down? Because if this side's not going up, there's a problem, right? So you wanna, is there a shift? Okay, is there anything, is the trachea deviated? Is that the problem? How well is he breathing? What's his rate? What's his O2 stat? Is he on oxygen? Does he need a bronchial breather? Maintenance of speed, proper cautions, I already talked about. They're gonna be on the collar. If they're unconscious, you use the jaw thrust maneuver versus the head tilt, chin lift, okay? So, move it as you can. Do they need to be intubated? Are they already intubated? Is there an obstruction? They may have someone who was like in a motor vehicle accident, they were intoxicated and they were obtunded and all this stuff, may have a nasal trumpet in to open their airway, or they may have an oral airway in. You may have to use rapid sequence intubation, which I already know about, if the patient needs to be intubated. Fire patient, okay, let's say a patient that has fire trauma. So if a fire patient comes in and he talks about being hoarse, your doctor's gonna wanna intubate that patient. Because a hoarse patient is possibly starting to do the swelling. If he gets a laryngeal spasm, he won't be able to get an ET tube in. So yeah, you know, your ER nurses are very, very good at rapid sequence intubation. You may have to do cryotherapy if the airway is obstruction. If they have a facial wound, say like a gunshot wound to the face, or anything like that, they will have to put in a trach for that patient because they won't be able to do anything. All right, B is for breathing and ventilation. So what kind of O2 are they on? I already talked about respiration, steps, quality. If a patient's got a breathing problem, we're gonna do an ABG. So we're looking for what with an ABG of this kind of patient? They're not breathing, we're going to worry that they're going to be acidotic, right? So we watch for respiratory compromise, these signs and symptoms, difficulty breathing, paradoxical chest movement. I already said, if they're not doing this, and they're doing this, there's a problem. Absent or decreased on one side, cyanotic, if they're blue, if they've got a sucking chest wound, if they've got a penetration wound, if they've got fractured ribs, are they tachypneic, tachycardic, do you have the decreased hypotension, and what's gonna tell us our level injury? Gotta have a chest x-ray. Most, the emergency room at Willsite North, the radiology department's in the basement, but for the emergency room, there is the table that's inside the emergency room, and then the CT scan is across the hall. So those patients, or those two are designated just for that. They sometimes may bring hospitalized patients if the other CT scan, but mostly inpatients are taken care of in the basement and portable, and those two are specific for the ER. So that means they don't have to clear the table. The only time they would have to clear the table in the emergency is if somebody else in the emergency room was on the table. Circulation, we're looking for shock, right? We're looking for bleeding. What do you associate shock, the term shock? If I say a patient's in shock, what am I talking about? I'm talking about a drop in blood pressure, okay? I need to find out on my patient what kind of shock, but that's the definition of shock, is a drop in blood pressure. Hypovolemic shock is the most common form of shock in traumatic injuries. Motor vehicle accident, internal bleeding, just be as bad as, you know, something you can see visibly from the outside. Stephanie here got to see what internal bleeding looks like with a patient this week. Had to open up her microbowel patient because they needed a sternotomy that y'all heard about when y'all talked about the cabbages and stuff. Same principle. And they sucked out about how many canisters?
Three
big canisters. The woman had a leak from her surgery, and so, but and ultimately had to go back to surgery. But yeah, and they can, you know, they fill up the chest. So we really about that. So it decreases your preload. It decreases your cardiac output, which is going to decrease what? Y'all are brain dead. I don't even know why I'm up here. All right. So anyway, it's going to decrease your blood pressure. All right, maintaining perfusion. Want a MAP that's less than 60 with evidence of decreased perfusion? Okay, what did it take? If you have a MAP of less than 65, what's not being perfused? Your vital organs, okay? So that always needs to be at the forefront of your head. Cardiac output, how do I know I got a good cardiac output? How do I know I have a good cardiac output if my patient doesn't have an ART line? I mean, if my patient has an ART line, I got cardiac output, cardiac index, SVR. But what do I have? Tell me that my patient's being adequately perfused that doesn't have an ART line.
The MAP.
There's one more thing. If your patient is on an automatic blood pressure, when you take your automatic blood pressures, which everybody does now, I'm not gonna lie, when was the last time you used a manual blood pressure cuff?
First level.
Come on. It's fundamentals. Y'all know it. And that was just in lab, right? Everybody uses the automatic blood pressure cuffs now. There's a number in parentheses. You have your systolic and your diastolic. You have a number in parentheses. What is that? That's your MAP. If your MAP is less than 65, you need to do, what's the first thing you do if your MAP is less than 65? Not rocket science. What's the first thing you want to do if your patient has a wonky blood pressure? Do you just accept it for what it is?
Retake it.
No. You look at your patient and go, oh, you got a wonky blood pressure. I'm going to readjust this cuff. I'm going to move it to the other side. I'm going to go get a manual. Right? So you're going to not just take it for face value. It's like the patient that's got squigglies, you just automatically say they have defib, even though they're, you know, walking and talking and having a conversation with you because they're moving all over the bed and everything. And now they have, yeah, it's just artifact. All right, so mean arterial pressure is an indicator that your patient's vital organs are being perfused. Peripheral pulses may not be detectable, okay? You may not be able to feel your radial or your post-tibials. Those are the ones I'm talking about. So you feel your carotid, and if your carotid is palpable, then your blood pressure, your systolic is at least 60. If you can feel your femoral, it's at least 70, and if you can feel a radial, it's at least 80, right? So know that if you can't get a blood pressure, then at least by feeling, right? Classic symptoms of shock, cold, pale, a decreased capillary refill of greater than 3 seconds, and blue. So they classify shock, class 3's volume loss of 30 to 40% of their blood volume. All right, this is a picture of the rapid infuser. It's called a level one. That's what the big one in the middle stands for. We use it for a class of things. We can give immediate crystalloids. Colloids are volume expanders. We may be giving, until we can get the blood started, they'll be given fluids. They give lactated ringers. A lot of times people are getting away from using normal saline because of what it does to the pH. And you'll have a lot of facilities. I know Willis Site North is going to start using something called normal salt because it matches the body's pH more accurately. So they'll be using that. It's just whatever your facility is. But just know that it's a crystalloid that's being used as a volume expander because we're trying to catch up with the blood that we lost. But the ultimate thing is if your patient's lost a lot of blood is you got to give them what? Blood. Okay? So you might give them a couple of units of blood and then some fresh frozen plasma. And then you might give a plasma expander, you might give them some albumin. So, and it's this 5% albumin. 5% albumin is not to be confused with 25% albumin, right? So if you see 5%, that's volume. 25% is pressure. Okay. Okay, I already told you about the rapid infuser, it warms it up. Okay. So, seize circulation, we're going to try to control their hemorrhage. Take their vital signs. Your skin can tell you a lot of things. Your blood pressure, your heart rate, their altered mental status, their level of consciousness. Do they have a weak, thready pulse? Do they have delayed capillary refill? What is your job as a nurse? Patient comes in. Now, chances are, emergency staff has already gotten a large bore needle in. If you only have one 18 in, put in a second one. If you don't have an 18 in and they've got two 20s, put in two 18s. If you can get a 16, all the better, because you need to get a lot of fluid in your patient. Because if you lose your patient's blood pressure, what are you not going to be able to do? If you lose a patient's blood pressure and they dilate and they are vasodilated and all their veins are flat, you're not going to be able to get any kind of access. They don't dilly-dally in the field. If they can't get a line, they go ahead with the OS and put it in the, well, now they put it up here. But you used to put it in the that flat part of your shin. It's like a flat diagonal. You can screw it in and you can get fluid. They say now that they're using the humerus bone first. You can't send them to the floor with this. And you have to, you know, hopefully get enough fluids in so you can pump them up and then somebody can get in the central line. But if your patient is vasodilating and is losing their blood pressure, you can try a million times, but they have flattened their veins out so much, you're not going to even get in a central line. I've seen that happen with a patient who's in septic shock, whose blood pressure was 60. It's just not going to happen. So that's what you have to worry about. It's getting all that, you get a fluid in them as quickly as possible, and you can save the vascular system, get your blood pressure up so we can get the drugs in that you need. When it comes to giving blood cells, giving blood in an emergency situation, emergency release. Okay, so, you know, patients bleed all over the place. Do we take them? Okay, we need to give you blood, but we need you to sign this piece of paper so that you understand all the risk involved. Do we do that? No. We do that later. Oh, by the way, we gave you 8 units of blood. Could you sign right here? We sign it after the fact, okay? We sign, this is emergency, you know, it's a lot. So we just get emergency release. Then we type across and we get the kind of blood that they actually have when we have more time. So we give them the universal blood in the emergency situation. Control the bleeding, monitor the labs and the urine output. Who said that urine output was the other indicator of cardiac output? Yes, very good. So how much urine does your patient need to be put out an hour to verify that things are pumping like they should? 30 an hour. So how often do you think you need to be charting INO in this situation? Every hour. Dysrhythmias. D for dysrhythmias. Depends on the injury, age of your patient. PEA. Do I need to tell you about PEA? What does PEA stand for? That's right, pulseless electrical activity. What do you do for it?
CPR.
High quality CPR and the drug choice?
Epi.
Epi. Do we shock them?
Nope.
Why not?
They already have electricity running.
What we do, on the other hand, is try to do what? H's and T's, right? And our H's and T's are hypovolemia, hydrogen for acidosis, attention pneumothorax, a cardiac tamponade, hypoxia, and hypothermia. Pulmonary emboli, hyperkalemia, and an overdose. These are all the things that we take into consideration once we've gotten the patient stabilized if we don't have that information, all right? We gather this information. We get the hypovolemia, we get the acidosis, we get the tension pneumothorax. We get all this when we start drawing labs, doing x-rays, assessing the patient, all right? And then you have idioventricular, and you just treat it as a PEA or a systole. Any questions? Okay. Disability. That's our neurological status, what your patient comes in. The rapid assessment is called the AVPU. Not to be confused with the Glasgow. Right? Is your patient alert? Does your patient respond to verbal stimuli? Does your patient respond to pain? Is your patient unresponsive? One of the things is when a patient comes in that's had an accident, has a brain trauma or anything like this, and they're still breathing on their own, is what's the one thing, we've already talked about this, what's one thing that needs to be considered? We need to make sure we're looking for brain activity, right? Because if we don't have brain activity, what's in the back of our mind of a healthy 30-something motor vehicle accident with no obvious injuries other than he's organ unconscious? Donation. Would he be a candidate for organ donation? So they're looking for these kinds of things. So they're looking to see if he responds, if he withdraws respect from pain, and if he's unresponsive. I had a couple of people that had the opportunity, they had a patient came in, not this week, but last week, and they got to, the LOPA person was called in because they thought that this patient was gonna be a donor. Very interesting is they kind of went through the things that they were gonna do with him as far as determine if he was suitable. As far as they knew, this patient had high blood pressure and hypothyroidism. But when they started doing further investigation, they found that this man had an undiagnosed mass. Is that correct? Am I correct with that? That he had a mass. So after that, they said, well, he's not going to be a donor, but he's still, you know, he's still being kept alive by the machine because he wasn't breathing on his own at all, was he? Yeah. So he wasn't breathing on at his own. So they were going to do a test where they put cold water in his ear. They were going to do a deep pain to see if he withdrew from the pain. They were going to do all of these, the neurosurgery staff doctor was going to, and they were going to do an EEG for brain activity. So they were doing all these things before they, you know, before they had the family, you know, withdraw care. So that's the rapid assessment. Then you have your Glasgow, which I should already know about, which has to do with eye opening, best verbal response, best motor response. And when do we call up with Glasgow less than 5? Was it 5? I think it's 5. Right? 5. Right. So we call, we do an initial CT. That's why we call the level 1, so that if CT has a patient on the table, they can move things along. Not put that patient on the table, divert them downstairs, or whatever. Spinal precautions. And if they have a head injury, and Ms. Akins is going to talk more about this later, intracranial pressure control. Any obvious deformities as far as pain? I mean, as far as fractures, bones? Do they have any facial fractures? Do they have arm fractures, do they have ribs sticking out, do they have any compound fractures, you're looking for that. Pain, quality, looking for that, okay? Any questions? These are our diagnostics, these are all the things we do. We do CBCs, we do chemistries, we do COAGs. Why do you think we do toxicology? Do y'all think that we do toxicologies and have these people arrested? Yeah. We do the toxicology to see if there's things that need to be taken into consideration with their treatment, all right? You don't judge or anything like that. X-rays, chest X-rays, fracture X-rays, CT, MRIs, EKGs. We do cerebral angiography for head traumas, electroencephalography for head traumas, the Glasgow, intracranial pressure monitoring. You might have to do a lumbar puncture. And all right, so that was A, B, C, and D. EFG, expose your patient. You cannot assess the patient in a full set of clothes, right? So what do you need that's very important? You need shears. You need to start, that's one of the things that part of the team is going to be doing is when they come in, is they're just going to start cutting off clothes. And they don't care how expensive they were, they're cutting them off. So they cut off, if they can't help take them off, they're going to cut them off. Full set of vital signs, comfort as far as pain, position, unless they're still in cervical, until after their, after that cervical spine has been cleared, the doctor's going to come in and take off the collar. Or the doctor will tell you, I've checked the CT scan, he's got clearance, you can take the spine collar off. Right? And then you want to make sure you get every past, any past medical and surgical history that might not have been in the sample. Oh, I think I'm done. Okay, I'm done with this one. Y'all have questions on basics?
This one.
Yeah, it's just common. It's just going to be, they're going to get a blood alcohol level, and they're going to get just your basics. You know, anything more severe, they have to send out for. All right. Quickly, we're going to go over the other problem. These are non-neurological. Ms. Akins is going to do your non-neurologicals. All right, thoracics, big ribs, spleen, liver.
Okay, she's got to increase the size of that.
Single rib fracture can be the most common blunt trauma. Anybody go skiing? Yeah. Yeah, you protected your head, you know, but if you're not careful, you know, people, like, if you're a ski, any ski boarders? Okay, well, you can just ignore what I'm about to say. So ski boarders have a tendency to not pay attention to what the skiers are doing, and they fly by and everything, and they knock them off their skis. You can hurt them. So be very careful. That happened to my husband. Anyway, he ended up fracturing ribs, lacerating his spleen, everything. And so sometimes you don't see a rib fracture. We didn't know it. You know, you don't know any of it. And all of a sudden, he starts, you know, getting very cold and clammy and passes out. All right. So what lies beneath the first and second ribs? Where's your first and second ribs? I didn't clap. Well, here's your first. Here's your second. What? They're great vessels. So if these get fractured, then you're at risk for puncturing the great vessels. So be careful of that. Then what lies between the 10th, the 7th and the 10th, and that's your, you know, your liver and your spleen. So that's what happened. You got hit on this side, fractured the ribs, they lacerated the spleen. They will complain of pleuritic chest pain that increases with compression over the site. Compression meaning you press on it. Does this hurt? Yes, that hurts. And they might be splinting. You gotta have a chest x-ray to diagnose a fracture, and we'll do continuous evaluation of the respiratory effort. What happens if our patient doesn't take deep breath or breathe normally and they're starting to hold CO2? Yeah, they can get acidotic really easy. So you might want to give them supplemental oxygen to compensate for it. And you want to control their pain, because people who are in pain don't do what? They don't breathe effectively. People who have been given pain medicine don't do what? They don't breathe effectively. So how are you going to monitor your patient's oxygenation? It's on their finger. O2 sat monitor. Okay. Make sure they don't have any previous pulmonary history. Okay. Oh, let's talk about the hemothorax. So a hemo and a pneumothorax, they're accumulation of air or blood in the pleural space. Usually happens from rib fracture, blunt penetrating trauma, or it could be spontaneous. And if it's ongoing, they may have to have a CVAT placement. So they have signs and symptoms of difficulty breathing. There can be the shift. They get chest x-rays. They'll have a decreased movement of the affected sides. Like I said, instead of going up and down and up and down, it's up, up, up. Okay. Deviation of the trachea. Absent or decreased breath sounds on the affected side. Difficulty breathing, shortness of breath, DSAT. Might have an elevated heart rate. And we don't use a lot of percussion, but they'll hear your doctor might hear hyporesonance treated with, if it's less than 20% of stable lung space, it might just re-expand on its own. If it's unstable, then we have to put in a chest tube or Heimlich valve. And everybody's seen chest tubes in their clinical experience this semester, right? Yes? Is there anybody that has not seen a chest tube yet in their clinical? You haven't seen a chest tube? Where are you doing clinical? Where are you doing clinical? Well, I know you're going to see chest tubes because everybody... Have you ever been on Tube West yet, have you? Have you been to CCU? You will. Are you going to CCU next week? Okay, well, you're going to see chest tubes next week. You need to get someone to show you chest tubes, okay? Because I can talk about chest tubes all day long, but unless you see a chest tube, it means absolutely nothing. All right? I mean, like, nothing. You got to see it in action. All right, attention pneumothorax is a life-threatening emergency. It can come from perforation of chest wall or pleural space, secondary to a blunt or penetrating trauma. Air enters with each breath and becomes trapped, which collapses the lung. Here's a picture. Positive endothorax pressure, which is supposed to be what? It's supposed to be what? If positive comes in, it's supposed to be negative, right? So it's going to cause these shifts. They're going to be, anything respiratory. Difficulty breathing, cyanosis, decreased breath sounds on the affected side. Tracheal deviation, mediastinal shift, they'll drop their blood pressure, they're going to get tachycardic, they may talk about chest pain referred to the shoulders. Emergency treatments, they need a thoracotomy or aspiration. Thoracotomy is, boom, put the hole, so open it up. Put a chest tube. An open pneumothorax, that's a sucking chest wound. Can be heard on inspiration. Look at this picture right here. Give your attention to that picture. It's secondary to a penetrating trauma. It's an open communication with the atmosphere. Air is getting sucked in, resulting in the collapse of the lung. Can become a tension pneumothorax. You treat it, you put an occlusive dressing. If y'all seen the Vaseline gauze, you heard about the Vaseline gauze? Okay, that's what we call the occlusive. Put the Vaseline gauze on top of it. And then you tape it on three sides. So it'll pull his chest wall, preventing the air from entering the chest. And until you get a chest tube placement or surgical repair. Flail chest, on the other hand, is where ribs have been fractured in two places. You have chest walls continue disrupted. You'll be able to kind of see this. You get a visual. Fractures look like they're in segments. You'll have paradoxical chest movement. You can have hemorrhage, edema, crepitus from the damaged underlying tissues. You'll be able to hear this crackling underneath the skin. They're splinting. They're not breathing because it hurts, as you can imagine. You may require intubation to stabilize the rib segment and for lung expansion. They evaluate them from acute respiratory failure and acute respiratory distress. If it's an anterior flail evident, watch for dysrhythmias and manage their pain. Pulmonary contusions from hitting dashboards and steering wheels or the floor from falls. Any kind of blunt force trauma, tears, lung tissue, you can have hemorrhage and edema. Alveolar expansion is decreased. It can lead to edema. It'll have capillary refill. Alveolar capillary integrity is destroyed, which means what's not taking place. If you have an alveolar capillary integrity destroyed, what's not happening? Because it's where it happens in the breathing process. You have ventilation. And then you have perfusion. And where does perfusion? Is at that membrane, right? So if that membrane integrity gets compromised, so you'll have signs and symptoms. You might have ecchymosis along the chest wall, hear crackles. They might have coughing up blood, shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, and unstable O2. ARTS may take place in 24 to 48 hours before the patient has symptoms. They have refractory hypoxemia, progressive hypercapnia, and respiratory failure. Be diagnosed with a chest x-ray. Within 6 hours, we'll see patchy area of density related to permeability of pulmonary edema. And you treat it the same as you would ARDS, which y'all just learned, okay? What position do I want this patient in? Yep. All right, a tracheobronchial injury. It's a penetrating blunt trauma cause. You rupture or tear your trachea or your main stem bronchus. Again, dyspnea, tachypnea, hemoptysis. Stridor is what you hear, okay? You might hear crepitus. Subcutaneous emphysema, where it feels like when you touch your skin and the air is underneath it, and it feels like Rice Krispies, okay, crunching. Do you ever explain that? That's what it sounds like, it feels like you're mushing on, okay. You might have airway obstruction, that's with the stridor. You might have decreased or absent breath sounds. The diagnosis is a bronchoscopy, a bronchogram. It has to have surgical repair. They might put an ET tube in distal to the injury. They might use chest tube. We'll see bubbling in the water seal until they fix the leak. They're high risk for a tension pneumothorax. All right, this is the whole point of this, is chest tubes, okay? Because nursing considerations with chest tubes. It's like the most important thing I'm gonna talk about right now at this moment is, what is your job with chest tubes, okay? You assist in the putting in of the chest tube, in the fact that the doctor says, I'm putting in a chest tube, there's two things you have to get. Well, three things. You ask him what size you want, what size Japanna do you want, so you go get the Japanna. You get the chest tube insertion kit, because it's under sterile setting, and what's the third thing you have to get? It's on the floor, has three columns, has a little thing that puts some water in it. The atrium. You got to go get the atrium, the chamber, right? You're responsible for getting all three of those. All right. CABG patients will have a mediastinal pleural, a pneumothorax to remove the air from the pleural space, be open for the penetration of the chest wall of pleural space, closed pneumothorax, only pleural space penetrated, hemothorax to remove the blood, and postoperatively for lung surgery. So these are the indications. These are the kinds of people that get chest tubes. We just don't put chest tubes in willy-nilly. You gotta have a reason. All right. Number one, inspect your dressing site. Four, drainage, fluctuation with respirations, hold tiling, and check your connections. So I'm starting here at the site. I'm looking at the drainage on my dressing, and some of them, they may have taken the dressing off. Usually it's got a little, that dressing that's got a cut in it, and it's got, so it just sits over it. Some of them have taken them off and you've just got it stitched in, and so you can, at the insertion, and so you're seeing, you know, the blood, you know, how it's like with respirations, it might go back and forth like that. And you want to make sure that all of your connections, that the chest tube is connected to the drainage chamber, and that the drainage chamber's tubing is connected to the chamber. You want to make sure that the chamber is securely on the floor and not at risk for being what? Knocked over. Because what's your job? You've got to keep up with how much drainage is coming out of that chest tube in an hourly period, in a 12-hour period, in a 24-hour period. And they watch those numbers very, very closely. So, somebody comes in, not paying attention to what they're doing, and they knocked over. And so now you've got little bits of fluid in all your chambers. What are you going to do? Some people will just go get a home chamber. Some people will mark everything, mark the lines, date it and time it, start all over, okay? Document that the, you know, that so that everybody knows that the chamber was knocked over and it's been marked and where it was, so everybody's on the same page. Do I document that the chamber was knocked over in the nurse's notes? God, no, who's doing that? That's not necessary. What's necessary is that everybody knows that the numbers are going to be off. You don't want them to be off. All right. Document the drainage, the color, the amount, like 300 mils in the first hour and then 100 mils the next 2 hours. So hourly. Now, that's in the unit. Some of you who work on step down where bypass patients go once they've gotten off the ventilator and they're stabilized, they'll go to the floor and they'll still have their chest tubes possibly and they check their every 4 hours. But I don't recommend you just every 4 hours it, you know, ignore your drainage. I see what you see what their you mark their level when you come in, what the last time it was marked, and then you're very cognizant, you know, every couple hours you check and see what it is. Because they're gonna come in and ask you how much did they put out. And so that's your responsibility to know how much was put out yesterday and how much was put out the day before, even though you haven't been there for 4 days. Right? It's your responsibility to know everything there is about your patient that has chest tubes. Maintaining the patency of the system, the amount and characteristics of suction being blood. Keep the drainage system dependent. When I say keep the drainage system dependent, what does that mean? Yes. So, patient goes to CAT scan. Patient has to go leave the floor for whatever reason, an MRI or nuclear medicine. There's hooks on the end of it so they can be on the bed rail or at the foot of the bed, right? Just make sure that once the patient gets back to the floor, it goes back. They're gonna be hooked up to suction for a little while. They're usually at a level of suctioning. I'll talk about bubbly in a minute. All right, represent the patient, may increase output, may also cause pain. The lungs aren't particularly fans of having this tube shoved in it. Have you ever seen a chest tube? It's not like it's a little IV catheter. It's big. It's like this big around, right? And so they're breathing, so the patients don't like it. And it really affects their pain level when they're in the recovery period. And so they will complain of pain. A leak. So air leaks are something you need to be aware of. So because it's a decreased inspiratory pleural pressures. It'll be a bubbling in the water seal. Now, there is bubbling that's normal and it has to do with you'll hear it rhythmically. If you hear it rhythmically, that means that goes with their breathing. But if it's a continuous bubbling, you got a problem. You've got a leak in the chest tube or in the lung. Differentiate between the two. You momentarily clamp the tube at the exit, that being where it comes out of the skin. If the bubbling stops, the leak is in the lung. If the bubbling continues, the leak is in the system. It's not unusual for a post-op or trauma, once injury heals, the bubbling will stop. If substantial, they may have to replace the chest tube. Maintaining the chest tube, do's and don'ts. Do not clamp the chest tube. When I said momentarily to see if there's a leak, that's just momentarily. May cause rapid transition to a pneumothorax, a tension pneumothorax. If it gets disconnected, you submerge it in room temperature water seal until you can replace it. Don't strip. Like you've seen people that had a JP drain and they took their fingers and they did this, don't do that. You can just milk it and get the clots and kind of go down into the chamber or move the what's in the tubing down into the chamber so you can measure it, but we don't strip. You don't clamp it for transport. Okay, no need to do that. If it gets pulled out, number one, remain calm. And you taste the Vaseline jaws, and apply pressure, and then you tape it on three sides, just like you did with the flail chest, and then prepare to replace it. Disconnection from suction, you just reconnect it to a new suction setup, submerge in into water. Right? Then when you disconnect, discontinuation is when the drainage has gotten to a low enough post-operatively or from the hemothorax. An air leak's not evident even with cough. Breath sounds are bilateral. Some people want chest pain, you want pain medicine before they get them removed. You have the patient take a deep breath. Oh, by the way, you're not taking out the chest tube, okay? That's not your job. Your job is to be standing there with the Vaseline gauze on top of the regular gauze, the hand of the doctor, so as he pulls out and he places over it and tape it and they didn't sign it, that's your job, right? And clean up the mess. They will pull and tie off the suture ends, put on the gauze dressing, and you're gonna, they will automatically get a order a chest x-ray, post chest tube removal. You're gonna listen for breath sounds, you're gonna watch your O2 sat, and you're going to check the respirations. You're gonna do this every 15 minutes at least for the first hour. With abdominal injuries, again, blunt versus penetrating, your hollow organs, your liver, your spleen, your colon, your kidneys, your bladder, they'll have abdominal pain, distension, looking for rigidity, rebound tenderness, if they're bleeding internally, their blood pressure is going to start dropping. Look for air and blood. They might have to use they'll get an ultrasound. This says a Doppler, we don't use that. They'll use an ultrasound. You might have blood in your NG tube, so the patient's got GI bleeding. Mostly you're gonna look for shocky blood pressure. A couple of signs we have called the Gray Turner sign, and it's bruising on the flank area. There's a picture of that. And then the Cullen sign is bruising over the umbilicus. There's a picture for that. This may indicate a retroperitoneal bleed. Mostly we're watching their blood pressures so that if they're bleeding, they can open them up. There's a liver laceration right there. Can be graded 1 to 4. They find them on CT, and the patient will have right quadrant pain. They'll have the Cullen sign, a Turner sign, they might have a Kerr sign. Surgically, they just go in and repair it. You're looking for typical hemorrhage, changes in their liver enzymes. Your patient might have some bile leaks. They might turn jaundice. They can easily get infected and have an abscess, but it can also lead to liver failure. And you can, the same thing with pancreatic injuries. Spleens, we worry a lot about spleens because what's the function of your spleen? Part of your lymphatic system, right? So it can be from lowest to highest. They'll see it on a CT. They'll have a drop in their blood pressure. They'll go in and treat it. A lot of people, Jason's was a small laceration and just kind of self-healed, but if they're really large, they'll take them, they take them out. The problem with taking out the spleen is that if they get an overwhelming infection, their lymph system is going to be compromised. That friend had lost his spleen from a childhood cancer, and then as an adult got an overwhelming infection a couple of years ago and got full-blown DIC and lost both legs, above the knee and both hands. But if he had had a spleen, he probably would have been in much better shape. Bleeding infection, of course. Nursing considerations. We treat with focused ultrasound, CT. This is a diagnostic peritoneal device. I've never seen that done. Angiography to see if they're getting the blood supply. Might have exploratory laparoscopic surgery. One of the things that you want to look is if your patient might be bleeding, is an increase in abdominal girth. So say my patient is in bed, and so I'll take the measuring from one end of the mattress and go over to the other end of the mattress. And I'll use that as my baseline. the, you know what I'm saying? It's like where his abdomen ends, like he's lying supine in the bed. This is his stomach, and I measure it from bed to bed. I don't have him sit up and measure all the way around it, okay? Because sometimes they don't want to move, but that's what it is. So you just, you're measuring their girth so that you can compare it. So the next day you go back 24 hours later, it's bigger. Is he complaining of more pain? The chances are he might be bleeding into his gut. Having difficulty breathing because it's pushing on the diaphragm. You might have a decreased urinary output because your cardiac output's being compromised. They might have blood in their stool, and they might have increased bladder pressure. All right, and one of the things you want to be concerned about is normal flora swimming around in your peritoneum. If you've had a colon, if you've got small or large bowel perforation, then you've got potential for E. coli also seeping into your bloodstream. So they might use, they'll do nutritional support for wound healing, or they might have to have a wound bag. Okay, these are my favorite. These are your maxillofacial injuries from being, you know, trauma to the face and the skull. It depends on, so these are three kinds of breaks, they call them. Yeah. Oh, that's not what I'm gonna do. It's okay. Let's go backwards. So. There. Okay, you got the Lafort 1, Lafort 2, and Lafort 3. And you can see the degree of separation. Like here's your, like, your maxillary. And then here's, it goes up into like your whole nose. And then here is just like, it attaches from the cheekbone, okay? So it's, you can see it's very serious. We want to be concerned about cerebral spinal leaks, but do not put an NG tube down this patient. Okay, if you see an order, okay, y'all gonna miss this on the test. You see an order for an NG tube for the patient that may or may not have one of these kinds of fractures, but they've got a facial fracture, and the doctor says, I insist that you put down an NG tube, then you insist that that NG tube be put down under fluoroscopy, okay? Because where are you gonna go if you're not careful? You're not going into his stomach. Where are you going? You're going straight up into that patient's brain. So, stand your ground, advocate for your patient, go, no. It's the same thing with a Foley catheter with a pelvic fracture, okay? If your patient has a pelvic fracture, don't put in a Foley catheter, okay? Two times. All right, here's our long bone fractures. You can have blood loss because it tears arteries and vessels. You want to stabilize because stabilizing will help your patient's pain. You worry about infection, which is osteomyelitis, but with orthopedic injuries and orthopedic surgery, but orthopedic injuries, bad embolism, okay? You want to be aware of the potential of bad embolism. There were a lot of people that went home with, you know, had hip fractures, little ladies, little men, go home, drop dead. They were doing fine in the hospital. What happened? Okay, so pelvic fractures, depending on the mechanism of injury, like I said, that that family got hit. There were five people in the car, four had pelvic fractures. Old people fall, can get a fractured pelvis, they're very fragile. You assess them, you'll see the doctor will come in and he'll do his hands on their pelvis to make sure that it's stable. If he has any questions, he sends them to the x-ray, and it comes back that they have a pelvic fracture, then they won't put in a they won't put in a Foley catheter. Or was it done yet? Got to worry about shearing of those large femoral arteries. Okay, ribs, I've already talked about, and ankles and wrists. All right, they go to x-ray. Now, if you get some kinds of, if you're working in the ER and you get hip, fib fractures, and ulna and radial fractures. Chances are you're going to set those in the ER under conscious sedation, and set it and refer that patient to, as long as there's not a compound fracture, and refer them to outpatient orthopedic surgery. A femur, a little more serious, chances are they're going to set that. You'll probably talk about this when you're in level two with orthopedic type injuries and surgeries and stuff. Fractured, if a patient comes in with a fall and they think they have a fractured hip, the telltale sign is that we look and see if one leg is shorter than the other. That patient's going to be in a lot of pain. So we put him in what's called Bugs traction, and we pull that leg, and it's attached to a weight, and it puts it out until we can get them to orthopedic surgery as soon as possible, as soon as they're stabilized. But otherwise, they're going to be in a lot of pain because it's off kilter. Any of them that are off kilter, they're going to be pain. If it's broken through the skin, it's a compound, it's an open fracture. Okay. Any questions? I'm done. Thanks for your attention. You're a great audience. Even though I know you're dog tired. Alexandria Nakish, any questions?